Good evening and welcome to the second panel of the 2020 Federalist Society Kentucky Chapters Conference. My name is Leslie Bilby and I'm a member of the Executive Committee of the Central Kentucky Lawyers Chapter of the Federalist Society, along with Tom Travis, Carmine Iaquino, Aubrey Travis, and Brett Nolan. We are pleased that you could join us for this session tonight on COVID-19 and constitutional law. Our moderator this evening is the University of Kentucky's General Counsel, William Throw. I will now turn the discussion over to Mr. Throw.
Thank you, and thanks to everyone for joining us. I know this is the dinner hour, at least in the eastern half of the state, so we really appreciate folks taking the time to hear from us. We have a very distinguished panel this evening. First up, we will have Vic Maddox, who is the Assistant Deputy Attorney General of the Commonwealth for Civil Matters. He'll be speaking on the constitutionality of some of the actions that have taken place in Kentucky over the last 7 months. He will be followed by Doug McSwain. Doug is a partner with the Lexington office of Wyatt, Tarrant & Combs, one of the state's premier law firms. He will, in effect, be taking the opposite position from Vic, defending the constitutionality of some of the positions so far. Then we are honored to have our state treasurer and a former president of the Federalist Society at the University of Kentucky, Allison Ball. She will talk about things from the treasurer's perspective. And then finally, we are greatly honored to have Hiram Sasser, who is one of the lead litigators with First Liberty, one of the leading religious liberty law firms in America. And he will be talking about the religious liberty perspective. To sort of start us off, I'd like to kind of go over two concepts in constitutional law, which I think are absolutely vital to the discussion that we're having today. The first is what I call constitutional sovereignty. Other folks might call the rule of law, but it is basically the concept that law, or more specifically a written constitution, is above any government official. This is not the United Kingdom, where the Crown and Parliament is sovereign. It's not the Soviet Union, where the party was sovereign. Here, the law is sovereign. And constitutional sovereignty had its beginnings in 1215 with the first Magna Carta, when a group of English barons forced the King of England to agree to certain limitations. But that document also contained a provision, Section 61, which provided for its enforcement. If 25 of the barons thought that the king was violating the Magna Carta, they were authorized to make war against him and depose him. Well, that original Magna Carta in 1215 was essentially ended in a disaster. The Pope nullified it, civil war broke out, and then in 1216, King John died. In 1216, a new Magna Carta, issued in the name of the new king, who was all of 9 years old, was virtually identical to 1215, but it got rid of the enforcement mechanism. So the king was sort of on his honor. There was no enforcement mechanism. And to this day, that's essentially how the British system works. But as British historian David Starkey has noted, in America, the barons won. We have an enforcement mechanism, and that enforcement mechanism is the U.S. Supreme Court or the state Supreme Court vigorously enforcing the state or federal constitution and making sure that government officials conform their conduct to the law. No one in America is above the law. The second concept is what I call the divided emergency power. Now, in Great Britain, the power to declare war and the power of commander-in-chief is merged. It's all in the name of the king, acting in the name of the prime minister. But in America, the founders recognized that that was too much power for one person. So they divided it. The president is commander in chief, which gives him the power to respond to a defensive measure, an invasion of the United States, or some sort of short-term emergency. But actually declaring war or responding to a long-term emergency requires the consent of the legislature. And we see this in all of the state constitutions, including our own here in Kentucky. And as General Cameron noted in his opening address for this conference, at some point, the executive power wanes and the legislature must step in. And as we are now 7 months into this pandemic, if we have not reached that point, then we are rapidly approaching it. So hopefully our panelists will add some enlightenment to my setup. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Assistant Deputy Attorney General Vic Maddox to talk about the current state in Kentucky.
Well, thank you, Bill. And I want to thank Leslie and everyone in the Lexington chapter and the national office as well for making this event possible. I should also say at the outset that everything I say tonight is my own, and nothing can be attributed to Attorney General Cameron or anyone in this office. So imagine, if you will, that you lived in Frankfort, Kentucky, and on March 1, you rocketed off to the dark side of the moon, where you were stationed for a month without any means of communicating with the Earth. When you left your home in Frankfort with the Capitol and its Supreme Court chambers, its legislative chambers, its executive office of the governor, which stood at the foot of the hill, you were a free citizen of a constitutional republic. And your rights were protected by both state and federal bills of rights. But when you returned just 30 days later on April 1, you learned the following. You're barred from leaving the state. Your family in Indiana are barred from visiting. And your governor claimed the power to station the National Guard at the border to enforce this edict in front of a federal judge. You're barred from attending church. Even though you're allowed to work in your downtown office with as many of your colleagues as you like, your family business has been closed. Everyone you know has been laid off, but you're free to shop as long as you like in any big box store of your choosing. You're barred from eating dinner at a restaurant or from gathering in groups larger than 10. You're barred from evicting the tenant in the rental house you own, even though your tenant hasn't paid rent for months and hasn't lost his job, and even though your mortgage payment is still due. Your orthopedic surgery has been canceled indefinitely. Your annual cancer screening has been canceled, and your visit to your cardiologist and even your dentist has been canceled. However, anyone interested in having an abortion is free to do so. You are barred from peaceably assembling, whether to celebrate a family wedding, provide a proper funeral, or to gather peaceably to protest your government's actions, unless the actions you're protesting are also disfavored by your governor, in which case you're free to gather in as many numbers as you like on the Capitol grounds, and the governor will in fact host your assembly from the veranda of his Capitol office and promote it on Facebook. So you might say to yourself, how is this possible? Well, especially how is it possible in light of a constitution which has Section 1 of the Kentucky Constitution, providing that all men and presumably all women are by nature free and equal, and they have certain inherent and inalienable rights, which include the right of enjoying and defending their lives and liberties, of worshiping Almighty God, of seeking and pursuing their safety and happiness, of freely communicating their thoughts and opinions, of acquiring and protecting property, of assembling together in a peaceful manner for, among other things, the redress of grievance, and finally, the right to bear arms. And in addition to that, Section 2 provides that absolute and arbitrary power over the lives, liberty, and property of free men exists nowhere in a republic, not even in the largest majority. And for good measure, the last section of the Bill of Rights, Section 26, provides that to guard against transgression of the high powers which have been delegated, we declare that everything in this Bill of Rights is accepted out of the general powers of government and shall forever remain inviolate. And all laws contrary thereto or contrary to the Constitution shall be void. And yet, on March or April 1, due to the edicts of one man, you realize that of the seven enumerated rights in Article 1, only one, the right to bear arms, remains intact. How is this possible, you might ask? And the answer would be because the General Assembly and the governor acted unconstitutionally. How is that so? Well, Section 39A, Chapter 39A of the Kentucky Revised Statutes provides for the emergency powers of the government. And of course, like every other governor in America, Governor Beshear declared a state of emergency on March 6th. KRS 39A sets out the legislative intent underlying the powers granted to the governor that arise during a very broad array of emergencies. They include such things as floods and tornadoes, wildfires, storms, hazardous substance releases, mass casualty events, and others. And there's a general catch-all provision for things like other technological, biological hazards, other disasters or emergency occurrences, quote, or other causes, close quote. So while being exceedingly specific as to multiple sorts of emergency triggers, the statute ultimately wanders into generalities so as to make it theoretically possible to apply to almost anything. Now, in fact, the statute which provides the governor's emergency powers is Section 100 of Chapter 39A. And theoretically, that requires there not only to be an emergency declaration, but also for the local officials in some other county or city to have declared that their resources are insufficient to deal with the emergency in their area. Of course, that never happened in this case. No local official ever declared his resources insufficient. Nevertheless, the governor invoked his powers under KRS 39A-100. And of course, 39A-090 says the governor may make, amend, and rescind any executive orders as deemed necessary to carry out the provisions of Chapter 39A. So we know that Section 39A-100 allows a variety of specific actions by the governor, but 39A-J provides that the governor has the power to basically do anything he decides is necessary or appropriate. Quote, except as prohibited by this section or other law, he has the power to perform and exercise other functions, powers, and duties deemed necessary by him, of course, to promote and secure the safety and protection of the civilian population. So this section was enacted in 1998, and so far as I know, it's never been challenged. But that's likely because it's only ever been applied to tornadoes, fires, floods, ice storms. Everything that this statute has ever been invoked regarding has been decidedly temporary and decidedly localized. Now, of course, the declared emergency is every square inch of the Commonwealth of Kentucky, every aspect of the economy, and based on statements made by the governor in briefs filed in court, it involves every aspect of the lives of every Kentuckian. The Commissioner of Public Health has declared that the rules imposed, the executive orders, and the like, have been of breathtaking scope. And yet, we have no idea when the declaration may end. For all we know, we're closer to the beginning of the declared emergency than the end. So, in effect, the Kentucky governor has been given almost unlimited discretionary power. And you might say, well, the United States Supreme Court has declared that these sorts of things are necessary in the context of a public emergency. There's the Jacobson versus Massachusetts case from 1905. It's been relied on by a lot of courts, including the Fifth Circuit in the Abbott case from August of this year. And basically, it says that there's almost complete deference to local officials when dealing with emergency powers. And yet, we know that Judge Jeffrey Sutton of the Sixth Circuit, who is a member of this organization, he appeared actually at the Louisville Lawyers chapter a few years ago to discuss his book, 51 Imperfect Solutions. Judge Sutton said that a grave threat to independent state constitutions and a key impediment to the role of state courts in contributing to the dialogue of American constitutional law is lockstepping. The tendency of some state courts to diminish their constitutions by giving excessive deference essentially to the way the United States Constitution has been interpreted. So does Jacobson present some sort of overarching endorsement of Governor Beshear's powers? Well, certainly not if Judge Sutton's view is adopted, and certainly not if the Kentucky Supreme Court or its predecessor court, the Court of Appeals, are following their precedents. In 1948, the Supreme Court, the Kentucky Court of Appeals, now the Supreme Court, said that Section 2 of our Bill of Rights is unique, only the Constitution in Wyoming having a like declaration. Of course, it prohibits absolute and arbitrary power over the lives, liberty, and property of free men. And the court said, so it may be said that whatever is contrary to democratic ideas, customs, and maxims is arbitrary. Likewise, whatever is essential to essentially unjust and unequal, or exceeds the reasonable and legitimate interests of the people, is arbitrary. And I would submit that Section 1, together with Section 2, with its ban on arbitrary and absolute power, and Article Section 26, which says that these rights are inviolate, mean that just as Judge Sutton has suggested in his treatise, 51 Imperfect Solutions, the Kentucky Supreme Court should find that Governor Beshear's actions have overstepped their bounds. In fact, Judge Sutton noted that a state-first approach to litigation over constitutional rights, quote, honors the original design of the state and federal constitutions. State primacy in guarding individual rights flows from the U.S. Constitution and one of its key structural guarantees of liberty, federalism. So it seems clear that what the governor has done violates Section 1 and Section 2, but it also violates the non-delegation clause. And this clause, as we know from as early as 1922 in a case called Silbert versus Garrett, is perhaps the strongest in the nation as far as separation of powers. The court said in Silbert, quote, perhaps no state forming a part of the national government of the United States has a constitution whose language more emphatically separates and perpetuates what might be termed the American tripod form of government than does our constitution. It actually has both a negative and a positive provision guaranteeing that one branch may not override or overstep its bounds. And we know, in fact, that the governor has violated the non-delegation doctrine. The plain language of Section 28 says that any power properly belonging to either of the others may not be exercised by one of those branches. This language has meant exactly what it says for quite some time. Now, in 1963, the court adopted a more, I guess you might say, liberal interpretation of the separation doctrine, owing to what it called the practical realities of the growing administrative state. But the reality is that the court is not at liberty to disregard or effectively amend the Constitution simply because of some concern for practicality. And even if the existing interpretation of separation clause and separation powers were to be adhered to, we know that what the governor has done and what the legislature did with Section 39A violates that doctrine. Last year in Beshear versus Bevin, the court noted that to be effective as a delegation of power from the legislature to the governor, there have to be limits imposed, and there have to be clear constraints and standards by which one can measure whether the governor is acting within the delegation. And of course, in that case, the court imagined a statute that said the governor has the power to suspend any statute and any law during the time when the legislature is not in session. That, of course, it said would be unconstitutional, as an unconstitutional delegation of powers. In this case, that's precisely what Chapter 39A does. The governor is given the power under Section 39A100 sub J to effectively do anything he believes is reasonable or necessary. In fact, I take it back. The word reasonable appears nowhere in the statute. He's entitled to do anything he chooses. And just for good measure, Chapter 39A180 sub 2 provides that any statute and any law in the Commonwealth that is in conflict with any order or any edict that the governor declares is suspended. So there couldn't be anything, I believe, that's more clear than the notion that the separation of powers has been violated. Now, there are a couple of cases recently, I'll just go through them quickly, that demonstrate this sort of approach to the consideration of state executive power in the face of the COVID emergency. In Michigan, just recently, in the case of In Re Certified Questions, the Michigan Supreme Court declared that the governor's emergency powers there were a violation of the non-delegation clause. She basically had assumed the power to exercise whatever power she chose and to issue whatever regulations she chose to, as the court said, quote, reorder the social life and to limit, if not altogether displace, the livelihoods of residents across the state and throughout wide-ranging industries. Of course, that's precisely what's happened in Kentucky. The Michigan Supreme Court struck that down, and it said, the consequence of the lack of meaningful standards is, quote, that the governor possesses free rein to exercise a substantial part of our state and local legislative authority, including police powers, for an indefinite period of time. And they found that that was a violation of the non-delegation clause for its expansiveness, its indefinite duration, and its lack of standards. And I submit that those three findings apply with equal, if not more, force here in Kentucky. It's interesting, by the way, that Justice Markman of the Supreme Court of Michigan, who wrote that opinion, wrote in the Federalist Society's Journal of Law and Public Policy in 2008 that that court's dominant premise has been to get the law right rather than to reflexively apply precedent. He said, they want to move toward the best and most faithful interpretation of the law rather than reflexively acquiesce in prior case law that essentially reflected little more than the personal preferences of predecessor justices. And I would suggest to this group that any deviation from the provisions of Kentucky's non-delegation doctrine set forth in sections 27 and 28 amounts to exactly that, adopting little more than the personal preferences of predecessor justices. So the other case that I think is interesting is the County of Butler case that was decided last month by the Federal District Court in the Western District of Pennsylvania. That case is perhaps the most factually similar to Kentucky's. And there, the court noted that the government was, quote, not merely coming up with a draft of some theoretical white paper, but rather it was determining who could work and who could not, who would earn a paycheck and who would be unemployed, and for some businesses, which would live and which would die. And the court noted that if a government proceeds to shut down, quote, non-life-sustaining businesses or non-essential businesses, it can't do so in an arbitrary fashion. And of course, like Kentucky or like Pennsylvania, Kentucky defined what life-sustaining was or what non-essential businesses were. They were simply shut down. In fact, the Pennsylvania approach was more tailored and more reasonable than Kentucky's. In Pennsylvania, the governor decided on a regional basis or a county-by-county basis, not so in Kentucky. Even though Jefferson County has had thousands and thousands of COVID cases, and the restrictions that I outlined at the beginning were put in place in Kentucky at a time when dozens of counties in Kentucky had zero cases. So what the Pennsylvania court ultimately found in deciding that the restrictions in Pennsylvania were unconstitutional was that they lacked any objective definitions or measurable criteria. And in Kentucky, I think that's even more true. For instance, consider the fact that in August, an Open Records Act request was submitted to the governor, and it asked for, quote, the scientific data and records proving the validity of the public statement made by the governor that, quote, the fact is many Kentuckians are symptom-free carriers spreading the disease to our most vulnerable. The request also asked for, quote, statistical data and information proving that symptom-free carriers are holding back our economy. Surprisingly, a few weeks later, the governor's office provided this response. The office of governor, this office conducted a search for these records, but did not have any responsive records. What? You might say, how is that possible? You shut down the entire economy? You put a million people out of work. You cost the Commonwealth up to $26 billion, according to testimony submitted in one of our cases. And you don't have any scientific data or any records to support your approach, to support one of your major premises. If that's not arbitrary, I don't know what is. or consider the fact that in the case of daycares, the Commissioner of Public Health admitted that when they shut down daycares and then allowed them to reopen, but could only have 10 children in a group, he said there was no medical data to support that. When asked why the Florence Speedway had to have parents and children sitting 6 feet apart, even though they arrived at the Speedway in the same vehicle, he said he had no answer for that question. So again, there is, as in Pennsylvania, no objective standards and no measurable criteria by which any of these restrictions have been imposed. I can talk about the level of scrutiny, but I will just say that the Pennsylvania court determined that the Jacobson approach, with what it called a free-floating rubber stamp for any action taken by an executive in the context of an emergency, was plainly not constitutional in the modern framework. And that's why perhaps the Supreme Court in the last decades has developed its multiple levels of scrutiny. That court also noted that even in Jacobson, the Supreme Court explained that the police power of a state must be held to embrace at least such reasonable restrictions established directly by legislative enactments as will protect the public health and the public safety. And of course, in this case, our governor declares the right to exercise police power when, so far as I know, no court has ever found that an executive has police powers. That power belongs to the legislature.
Thank you, Vic. Let's go to Doug, who I think has a slightly different view.
You're on mute, Doug.
Doug, unmute.
Thank you, Bill. Can you hear me now? Appreciate that intro. Thank you, Vic. I do respectfully disagree with much of what you have to say. And I think mostly I would have to say this. I understand the Kentucky Constitution Section 28, and it says the powers of one branch of government are not to be exercised by another. And that's all well and good, except our Supreme Court, formerly the Court of Appeals of Kentucky, has long recognized that there is, in fact, not a neat boundary between what might be called executive powers or the governor's powers and in certain realms and legislative power. This is particularly true when it comes to, I guess if we thought of it at the federal level, of the commander-in-chief. There is no doubt that a commander-in-chief out in the field is exercising executive power, but that commander-in-chief is also going to be having to deal with civilian population. Civilian population that are families to the soldiers under the command of the commander or sub-commanders, and the civilian population with which they must engage going around and carrying out their military functions. So there is no doubt in my mind that the exercise of what we would all agree, I think, military functions is absolutely executive in nature, that it also involves the impact on private lives, private civilian lives. And so I don't believe that a proper recognition of what the practicalities of the powers may be is inappropriate, and I think is constitutionally has to be recognized. And I think our courts have done just exactly that in Kentucky. It is entirely possible to understand the executive power to be, after 9/11, to involve nothing but civilians. I guess one could call our firefighters as military or quasi-military. We certainly would think of the police officers as quasi-military. And yet There's no doubt that in a situation such as 9/11, our first responders are clearly in a quasi-military capacity, and they are going to be called to carry out executive functions that have impacts upon private lives. So a neat distinction between legislative power and executive power does not, in my mind, abide. And there has to be practical realities recognized, as just our Kentucky courts have done. Now, that stated, doesn't mean I want to see the executive be out legislating and doing things outside of the context of what an appropriate situation might call for the exercise of executive powers. And I think that's precisely what KRS Chapters 39A through 39F have done. I think they have recognized, just as, by the way, and I have looked at the emergency management statutes throughout the country, and Kentucky is no outlier. In fact, is virtually every state in the country, bar none, has emergency management statutes. Some of them are better written than others. And in Michigan, we have some that clearly had a problem. And I will deal with the Michigan situation in a minute, since you talked about the Michigan Supreme Court decision. But I will say this, emergency management statutes exist in almost every state. I haven't checked every state. And the reason I qualify my answer of almost, I have looked at least 40. And I know that at least 40 states have got similar emergency management statutes. Now, that stated, the emergency management statutes do vary in their specificity, and they do vary in their delegation of powers to their executive in emergency situations. Some of them have clear-cut short time frames for which the executive may exercise the emergency management powers. And in fact, in my review of the around 40 states of the emergency management statutes of the various states, Michigan happens to be one that's the shortest. In Michigan, the Emergency Management Act has a 28-day effectiveness written in the statute, so that the governor can declare an emergency and it's effective for 28 days, and the legislature's got to be called into session and has got to ratify it or not. And the truth of the matter is, and the situation in Michigan is a fascinating one, there's two statutes that are at play there. There's the Emergency Powers of Governor Act that was passed in 1945, and then there was the Emergency Management Act that was passed in 76. But most of the statutes, the emergency management statutes that exist around the country, came into play sometime during the 70s, 80s, and 90s. Some of them had, and I think their unique situation, outlier situation in Michigan, is their first act went into play in 1945, primarily because of the Detroit riots that occurred, during wartime, World War II in 1943 and 44, and it got much out of hand, and they wrote a very broad statute granting emergency management powers to the governor in 1945 in Michigan, and those powers only had used the words reasonable and necessary under the circumstances to protect property and public health or lives or whatever. It basically was very broadly written, and it had no confining definitions in it. Whereas the 1976 Act in Michigan had lots of definitions in it, much like our KRS Chapter 39, by the way, and 39A through F, and because of those definitions, I think that's what makes our situation much more akin to what was the act at play in Michigan. The only difference being that I've seen of substantial nature is the 28-day limitation under the Emergency Powers of the Governor's Act of 1976 in Michigan relative to our 39A to 39F. We don't have a limitation on time. That would be something I would engage with you on. I at times wonder whether or not an emergency declared in a circumstance such as this ought to be able to go on ad infinitum. But we'll discuss about time limitations that possibly ought to be considered on these things. But generally, I do not think that 39A does as you characterize it as. I think the powers that are laid out in 39A are clearly defined. There's all sorts of definitions in our act that describe what an emergency situation is, what a catastrophe is, what a disaster is, when it can be declared. I respect the disagree with your reading on the fact that only the governor can act on authorities. That is not the way it reads. And when you have the necessity clause for it, you'll see that there's clearly the legislative intent that the governor can exercise all the powers. Oftentimes, he should be working in cohorting with local officials, especially when it's a more local-oriented emergency or disaster. What we're dealing with here is an act that is necessary, in my mind, and 9/11 is a good example why we have to have emergency management statutes for the threat that occurred in the country by the early 1960s when we all were afraid of a potential burden up. Am I talking too fast, or is it my audio not being correct? Can anybody tell?
Your microphone seems to be breaking up.
Okay. Well, I will try to slow down, and feel free to let me know if it is breaking up further. I don't know if it's background noise or not that's causing a mic to go in and out. But in any event, I do think emergency management statutes are very much required throughout our country in case we would ever have 9/11 or if we would ever have another drill exercises or war that we need to be able to respond. There's no question that the Kentucky statutes 39A to 39F put all the powers of the governor in these emergency situations, particularly when they define things such as a pandemic or epidemic as part of a public health threat. When they define that as the kind of catastrophe, of course, the governor can exercise power to declare an emergency. In those situations, it is a power that kind of goes down through homeland security type functions, and military functions of the National Guard interface with that. It's a coordinated kind of response power. And I do believe that it's the true essence of what the executive power is. We have to have the ability to be able to, in a civil event situation or homeland security situation, with the executive carrying out those functions in a coordinated fashion with the military. That is the essence of what I think 39A does. It's got good definitions in it that trigger the powers into play and allow the governor to know when it's appropriate to declare the emergency. And then it goes through, and I would differ with your interpretation, Vic, on KRS 39A-100, because I do believe that it lays out lots of specificities of the kinds of powers that can be done. Just like if one were writing power of attorney, you give all sorts of broad powers to your power of attorney. In my mind, they have laid out specifically the kinds of powers. And in Kentucky also, and I know my time may be running close here, I don't want to run out, but I will say this. It's not like our legislature did not act on this. Our legislature in Senate Bill 150, as well as a later one, I believe 361, they basically ratified the governor's actions of the declaration of the emergency. That's precisely what the legislature needs to be doing. They can certainly do whatever additional actions that they need to do to check him if they believe that he has acted inappropriately in the upcoming next legislature. So in my mind, this is precisely the kind of constitutional action that needs to be taken in a broad step to address an emergency situation. And it's got legislative verification completely different from what happened in Michigan, where the legislature refused to extend the 28-day deadline that applied in the Emergency Management Act of Michigan. The legislature said, no, we're not extending it. And as you may recall, back in the spring in April and May when the legislature was meeting in Michigan, there was a great big turnout of protesters to the governor's actions in Michigan, just as there was here in Kentucky too, many protesters, and people are free to protest. I have no problem with that. All I'm saying is that there was a real turn of tide in the Republican legislature there based upon the protesting that was occurring, and they just didn't want to extend the governor's emergency powers. and the Supreme Court of Michigan properly held that that refusal meant that you had no more power to issue executive orders. And the governor up there did issue executive orders even after the legislature refused to do the 28-day extension beyond. She used the Emergency Powers of Governors Act of 1945 and used that as the basis of her further declarations, notwithstanding the legislative check on her. And in doing so, that issue is what was framed before the Supreme Court of Michigan, and they said, no, the 1945 Act with no definitions and only using reasonable and necessary as the only constraints on the governor exercise of all these powers, that's not reasonable, that it's not necessary, and in fact, that's an unconstitutional non-delegation here in any event. And I don't think that the Michigan Supreme Court missed it. Frankly, I think they called it correctly. Had our legislature done something differently and not ratified in effect what the governor was doing, it'd be a whole different matter if the governor was continuing to extend emergency declarations, notwithstanding what the legislature might have said or done in any bills. But that's not what happened. And in fact, our situation is a perfect situation of what makes our governor's actions in the Commonwealth constitutional.
Thanks,
that's all. Okay, Bill.
Good job. We're now going to hear from Treasurer Ball, who is the only person on this panel who has actually been selected by the people of the Commonwealth to exercise authority. The rest of us do so indirectly. So, Treasurer Ball, turn it over to you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to try to be quick because we've got one more speaker. But in the background of all of this, of course, is something we all know, that Kentucky has a strong separation of powers doctrine. In fact, it's supposed to be the strongest in the entire country. We all know the apocryphal, perhaps even true story of Jefferson, and that he wrote the language in our Constitution that covers separation of powers. So it's a big deal in Kentucky, and it's something that's always guided me as the treasurer, because I believe that everything that comes out of my office is supposed to be constitutional. And that's been particularly hard during these last 7 months. One of the things that I feel like I'm supposed to do is review spending, make sure it's in line with the law, make sure it's in line with the Constitution. And there have been a few ways this has been particularly difficult during this time. And one way has been because we're acting in an emergency, we're acting quickly, and we're doing things differently, and we're doing things without the controls that we normally have. One way that I want to point to is CARES money that's come in from the federal government. We have about $1.7 billion with a B. I hope you can hear that with a B. That came in from the federal government to Kentucky, and we don't have a lot of controls in place monitoring that. Normally, I'd be able to see, because normally money in Kentucky is run by the general fund, and I could find out, is this constitutional? Is this correct? Is this being done the way it's supposed to? The way it's currently set up, we don't have those kinds of checks in place. In fact, when we first got these dollars, treasurers across the country were all meeting with each other over the phone once a week to try and figure out, what can we even do with this money? And for probably a few months, our consensus was, we're just going to invest it overnight because we don't know what to do with it. It's been kind of a nightmare knowing how to deal with it. And now we have the position where the governor is making distributions of these funds, and we don't have checks in place to figure out, are these constitutional? Are these correct? Well, this is just one example of what it's like being actually a part of the nuts and bolts of government, trying to act as that watchdog on taxpayer dollars, as that proponent, that watchguard on separation of powers. And as all of you have heard already, and I don't need to go into arguments that you've already heard, because we've talked about, is the governor acting in a constitutional way? Is he not? Is 39A constitutional? Is it not? I'm not going to get into that. There have been able arguments made on either side. But let's just say, for sake of argument, that the governor is acting in a constitutional way, and 39A is constitutional. If that's the case, then I think we need to revisit some things, because separation of powers in Kentucky, which we believe, it's a cornerstone for us, we believe that it should be strong, is so stretched thin at this point as to be almost non-existent. Except for the judiciary, that's the only one that's acting the way it normally would. Right now we have this weird blending of the executive and the legislature, and we've been doing it for 7 months. Doug, I appreciate you mentioning, when does this end? Because that's one of the questions I think that needs to be addressed. If you really do believe in separation of powers, then you have to be preserving it. And you also, if you do agree that there should be kind of an emergency path forward, well, then it has to have an end date. You have to have something in place. Does it end when the virus is gone? I'm not sure it's ever going to go. We have to make sure that we address this, I believe, and this needs to be a guiding principle for the future. When does an emergency end? I want to give you a couple really quick examples of what happens when separation of powers is so stretched thin as to be almost non-existent. Like I said, executive and legislature are merged. They have been merged effectively for the last 7 months. And you could argue whether or not the executive is acting in an executive way, but laws are being made and people are being made to conform with those laws. Well, what happens? Well, I want to give you two examples of things that we're seeing in Kentucky right now that I think should be a warning light to all of us that believe in separation of powers and believe that policy belongs in the realm of the legislature. And the first one I want to mention is unemployment insurance, which has been a nightmare in the Commonwealth of Kentucky. I mention that because my office is the one that actually distributes the checks. I don't verify the claims. I don't do that processing, but I make sure the money goes where it's supposed to. And I know many of you probably are aware of this, but I want to emphasize this. At one point in Kentucky, we had about 43% of the workforce on unemployment in Kentucky. And the governor was pushing very hard to make sure people were on unemployment at that particular point in time. We actually, for a while, had the highest number of unemployment in the country. We had about, at one point, just over a million people had filed unemployment claims in Kentucky. Now, that's staggering when you look at our population is, I think, about 4.4 million. So just under a fourth of our entire population, and that's not just the workforce, that's the entire population, was in unemployment. And I think this is something that happens when you have this blend of the executive and the legislature merged together. Normally, this is a policy decision. Normally, this is something that's more accountable to the people. Normally, it's dealt with that way, and you wouldn't have a runaway decision like with unemployment without having checks in place to make sure you can manage this. Another example is the lockdowns. Vic, you mentioned the arbitrary nature of some of the decisions, and if you look at states across the country, some have gone with severe lockdowns like California and New York. Florida has been more targeted. South Dakota has been absent. There have been no lockdowns. And Kentucky has been mixed, in fact, so mixed as to be arbitrary, which again shows this is the kind of decision that should be made by the legislature. These are policy decisions, and they have varying degrees of impact across the Commonwealth of Kentucky. They should be responsive to the people that live there. So those are just two examples that I want to mention. I see we're running out of time, and Hiram, I want to get to you because one of my concerns has been First Amendment activity during this time, and my office has been monitoring to make sure, as that watchdog, as that person is supposed to make sure the spending is constitutional, that we're not paying, for example, KSP to go and stop people from attending church or perhaps break up protests when they shouldn't. So this is an area that's been a great concern for me, and my office has done some investigative work into this. So Hiram, I know I definitely want to hear what you have to say about this, because I think this just further reveals why it is so important that we protect separation of powers doctrine, because it keeps things like that in check.
Thank you, Treasurer Ball. And with that, we'll turn it over to Hiram to talk about religious liberty.
Thanks for having me. And I always enjoy interacting with folks from Kentucky, from the home state of my family, from Sasser, Kentucky, you know, where London is. Just go 10 miles east and you'll find I'm from humble country folk that have been there for a lot of generations. But so it was sort of fitting that Louisville became the epicenter, or really the beginning of the religious liberty litigation during this COVID-19, considering that Louisville was actually the site of one of the earliest religious liberty cases in the country, Watson versus Jones, the Walnut Creek Presbyterian Church splitting over the issue of slavery and the Confederacy and that sort of thing. And that had to get sorted out with the Supreme Court deciding that government can't get involved in internal church affairs. I think that case was 1873. So Louisville, the mayor there had decided that not only was in-person church service a problem, but he thought that that drive-in church services would also pose a problem. I'm not really sure what the theory was behind that, because we never really got to that in the litigation. But somehow the virus would penetrate glass and steel and spread from vehicle to vehicle. I guess I don't know. So we filed that lawsuit seeking a TRO for Easter drive-in services on Good Friday, and then Judge Justin Walker issued his decision on Saturday afternoon, enjoining that prohibition on the drive-in church services. And our local council, by the way, I don't know if they're on, but Mike Swansburg and Brooke and Smith were fantastic on that case and helped us make things happen. And so I thought that was going to be it. That was going to be our brief sojourn into Kentucky. But then we started getting calls from folks in Kentucky about in-person church services there in May. And so we started looking at, you know, what was being allowed, what was not being allowed. And the problem, as we saw it, was that there were a lot of discrepancies between what was being allowed and then the church services not being allowed. So we ended up bringing litigation, and our local lawyer there was somebody, I don't know, one of our panelists probably knows, Joe Bilby. I assume you're a lesser half there, Leslie. But Joe is kind enough to be our local counsel on that and keep us out of trouble. And then the Attorney General Cameron joined that case and asked for a statewide injunction for indoor church services. And we were seeking the ability to meet indoors, but for a limited capacity and other CDC compliant provisions that would make it safe, but also allow them to continue on. And we were successful. We were able to get the Attorney General and our team were able to get a statewide injunction allowing for in-person church services. I think that I haven't revisited this, but I would assume that if there was some sort of significant escalation of disease or death or something of that nature associated with those victories, that somebody would have alerted us by now. So I'm going to take silence as that those things were operated safely and otherwise did not pose any particular problems. The problem with these cases has been that the free exercise clause is not as powerful as it once was pre-1990. There was an unfortunate decision, Employment Division versus Smith, that kind of put a wet blanket on the free exercise clause. Many states, including Kentucky, enacted a Religious Freedom Restoration Act. There's also a federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act that applies as to the federal government now only, not to the states and their political subdivisions. And that's as a result of a Supreme Court case, Bernie versus Flores, it said that the Congress lacked the power to impose the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which would impose strict scrutiny on all rules, regulations, or laws that would impact religious liberty in a substantial way. So what we were left with mostly is a freedom of assembly claim, which gets us a path to strict scrutiny, and then also a free exercise claim if we can establish that the type of activity that's being prohibited there, the gathering for church services, is being allowed in some there's some other comparator, some other secular comparator that's being allowed to take place. And we were able to identify many of those, both in the drive-in service, which was relatively easy, and then the in-person, which was a little bit more challenging, but we were able to Your governor had provided some odd exceptions, like as many as you want in an office. And then, of course, you had sort of, free-for-all at the grocery store and other locations. And so having a socially distanced, 25% capacity indoor service was, pretty tame compared to some of the other things that were being allowed. And so as a result, we had access to strict scrutiny. And really, there was nothing that was brought in the litigation that would sort of establish, we kind of waived. I don't want to say waived, but we just kind of left compelling interest off to the side and didn't really fight over that. Although I think I can go on a long discussion I won't get into, but if you're curious as to what the compelling interest argument would look like that we would have presented, it's in UDV versus Gonzalez. It's a unanimous decision, although Alito didn't participate because he had not been sworn in at the time when they had the argument. But that would outline our compelling interest argument. We pretty much focused on the least restrictive means, and that if you're going to ban indoor church services or indoor religious services, you're going to have to do so with the least restrictive means possible to achieve your objective. And we're going to measure that by your restrictions that you're going to place on other activities that could potentially produce the same level of harm. And that's basically where the state's arguments all fell apart. And so after that, there's been one more development that I think is you might find of interest. The Supreme Court Justice Roberts in a case called South Bay out of California threw some cold water on the religious liberty litigation for churches by basically saying that he's going to take a very narrow view of what an appropriate comparator is. And then there was the case out of Nevada, which had a comparator of casinos, and they only garnered 4 votes there as well. And so that made it a little bit more difficult. I don't think those decisions would have affected the Kentucky litigation, certainly not the drive-in service. And I don't think it would have affected the in-person service either, just because your governor had put a lot of holes in the regulation, and so it had a much more of a Swiss cheese feel than California or Nevada did, even with the casino exception there. But one development I'll share real quick in closing before we take questions and that sort of thing is we just had a win just last Friday, Friday evening at about 11 o'clock. We obtained a preliminary injunction in Washington, D.C., representing Capitol Hill Baptist Church. We were fighting there for outdoor church services where everyone was socially distanced and wearing masks, required wearing masks. So that was a fight. I mean, like the D.C., D.C. didn't want to allow that. Sort of makes, our things we were fighting in Kentucky seem, kind of tame. We ended up being able to prevail there under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, as it applies, obviously, to the federal government. And so stay tuned for some additional developments. Not only are we advancing strict scrutiny through the Religious Freedom Restoration Act there, but also there's another thing going on that has an impact on this, which is going on right now, the confirmation of a potential new Supreme Court justice that may impact the vote. We don't know where she would fall, but it's possible that Judge Barrett would join the other 4 dissenters from South Bay and sort of render Chief Justice Roberts irrelevant on this particular topic. So there's a lot more to be explored, but it was we've enjoyed a lot of success in the COVID litigation, but I think it's mostly because we have looked for places that had comparators that were very favorable for a straight free exercise claim, and for whatever reason, Kentucky ended up just being the place where. The restrictions and the orders that were put in place by the governor just were not as artfully crafted as would have been more beneficial to them in court if they had done a better job. So with that, I'm done, and then I guess we could do questions or however you want to do it.
Well, thanks to all of our panelists for some fascinating presentations. We do have a couple of questions, and I know that Hiram has about, I think, 10 or 15 minutes before he has a hard stop. One of the questions, and if you have additional questions, feel free to use the Q&A thing, is how does the analysis of Chapter 39A or the constitutional analysis in general reconcile with our state constitution's explicit enumeration of rights? Do those limitations impact the governor at all? For example, in fighting the pandemic, could the governor control the outflow of public information by censoring the state newspapers? Could the governor declare gun violence to be a public health emergency and end up confiscating firearms? So we'll throw that open to anybody that wants to take it.
Well, Bill, I'll just chime in quickly. 39A has a lot of provisions that are plainly constitutional. I mean, many of them are obviously executive functions. And Doug is right that there are plenty of definitions and the like. As far as firearms go, the statute accepts the regulation of firearms in at least three places, I believe. So I don't think there's any question that the governor could not use 39A to limit the access to firearms or try to confiscate them. But as far as reconciling his sort of open-ended power in 39A 100 subpart J, and if you couble that with 39A 100 subpart, 180 subpart 2, which provides for the suspension of any statute in conflict with his orders, I don't see how it's possible to reconcile those with the Bill of Rights, Section 1. Let me also just add, in response to Doug, and this may go into the question as well, there are a lot of definitions. One of the definitions in 39A sub 020 is Section 10, which defines disaster and emergency response to mean, quote, the performance of all emergency functions other than war-related functions for which military forces are primarily responsible. So I think there's a strong argument that just from the definitions alone, the governor is not exercising commander-in-chief powers, and his orders, his executive orders and his regulations have not been affected through the use of his military or commander authority.
And that, my response to that would be that Homeland Security functions are about as close as one gets to military functions. And my understanding is that the way the chain of command works is that the governor works through the Homeland Security Office, of which the Adjutant General serves. I could be wrong about that, but I thought that there was a direct connection or coordination function going on with the National Guard. But in any event, I think, and there was another questioner who I see on a Q&A, and I don't want to jump out of what you were asking, Bill, but somebody had a specific question for me, and if I may read it, it says the administration's comparison to the function of commander-in-chief is truly a terrifying one. The families involved and subject to those absolute powers are American families, not the people of an invaded nation. Unprotected by our constitutional provisions, are there no limits on the governor's powers once he decides his responsibilities resemble those of a military commander? So rather than typing an answer to that, I thought I would use this as an opportunity, Bill, with your leave, to go ahead and address that. In my view, the legislature has provided a lot of limits. We haven't talked about those, but they provided a lot of limits in KRS 39A.100. And I would encourage the questioner to take a look at that, and you will see that there are specific enumerated powers and functions that the governor may exercise when an emergency situation such as this happens. The one thing that we've kind of left open or dangling is how long does one emergency situation last? And I know you responded a little bit about that, Allison, as well. And I didn't get a chance to really speak much about that, but I do think that if there is a limit on this thing, It's a limit that the legislature ought to think about in terms of imposing a time limit on it. As I mentioned, I've looked at emergency management statutes that are all around the country, probably at least 40 states worth, and they all look very similar. It's amazing how much governors have these kinds of emergency powers, and they don't all have the same kinds of functions that they've been delegated under their state laws, but they're pretty broad. And I would say that maybe 10 to 15 of them, including Michigan, have got time limits on them. Some of them have got more reasonable. I think Michigan's a bit on the short side of 28 days. I saw some that go 90 days and a requirement that they're, I can't remember which state it was. One of them had a 90-day limit on it. Another one had 60. Another one had 30. But they vary on the time limits that are imposed on their delegated powers to their executives. And some of them even say, we know our session, our legislature is apt to be out of session. You've got your time to put it in emergency declaration. It will be effective for whatever number of days they've specified, and you shall call the legislature into session. And whether that's constitutional to compel the governor to call the legislature into session or not, I don't know. But if the governor knows that they're given an executive order that's only going to be effective for a short period of time, and we got a situation that is going to extend much longer than that, it seems to me that a governor, a prudent governor, would say, "I've got to call a session into play, and let the legislature now ratify my actions or not." And that, it seems to me, is the answer to the questioner, because at the end of the day, I do share a concern about unlimited powers in the sense of not unlimited, but unlimited extent-wise or length-wise. There probably ought to be some sort of a time limit imposed on how long a pandemic can be left in emergency situation without the legislature being called into session to ratify that. But that stated, I think that 28 days was probably too short, but I don't have a problem with there being the necessity of our executive needing to exercise executive powers, even of a quasi-military nature, when there is a situation such as this public health pandemic. It maybe hasn't been as violent in Kentucky as it has been in New York at an earlier phase of the spread, but there's no doubt that it has been a tragic situation. And if any of the people on this call in Kentucky have had somebody in a nursing home, you've probably experienced, as have I, with my own mother in a facility, being concerned with her every day, because there were people dying in that facility. And it was a very, very nice facility she's in, so to speak. It has nothing to do with the quality of the facility. It has to do with just, this is a fearsome disease that takes no prisoners. So anyway, I'll shut up.
Hiram, we only have a few minutes for you. So anything you want to add to either of the first two questions?
Well, I don't really have anything to add there. I can add to, the unfortunate thing is that the Article 6 of the Constitution, the guarantee clause, the guarantee for a Republican form of government as to the states, is not a justiciable issue, as the Supreme Court has ruled, and thus is not something that you can go seek the courts to use as in a general and broad sense. But I do think that Judge McFadden in the D.C. District Court and in the Capitol Hill Baptist Church case had a great line in there in which he said that at some point the slack runs out of the line for governments when they're invoking essentially Jacobson versus Massachusetts to say that there's some leeway there. But it's certainly not a leeway that extends into infinity. And as time goes on, the traditional rules of constitutional jurisprudence begin to apply in their normal way. And you also have to, Jacobson is, that's pre-formulation of strict scrutiny and our levels of scrutiny. It's sort of the kind of a Lochner era style case, and so it's not necessarily the type of decision that we would normally rely upon to have vastly increase government power. So I think at the end of the day, what we're looking at is that for most for most people, I think their understanding of these temporary emergency powers were the fact that, with the capital T of temporary, and localized and small, and for them to be used for this long is not what we were intended. And look, there are people would say, well, you know, what if there's some really bad problems or whatever? That's something a legislative body has to answer, because that's where the deals get cut. That's where everybody has their opportunity to make their case, and that's where they have the processes and procedures in mind. Just one last point I'll point out. We represented the Answers in Genesis, the Ark, you know, the big boat there in Kentucky, and love those folks. And great place if you've never gone. I'm sure most of you have been there, but we've been there and it's awesome. But they were struggling with, you know, how do they figure out what category they're in with the governor? I mean, you know, they're not a mall, but they have a lot of people moving around in there internally, like a mall. They're not a movie theater, but they have movie theaters. They're not a restaurant, but they have restaurants. They're not a retail place, but they have retail places. And so they're kind of an amalgamation of things. And so what we ended up doing is just picking an opening date that sort of satisfied almost all of those, you know, all those criteria. In other words, we'll just comply with the criteria that applies with all those subcomponents, and open when all those subcomponents are collectively allowed to open. And that's where they ended up picking the June 8 timeframe in which to open, and received very little to no pushback on that. But my point is that there were a lot of discussions that I was reading about in newspapers where people were basically going to the governor and asking the governor's permission to open their business. And I find that to be somewhat, I don't know how else to say it, but it's un-American. And we're not supposed to grovel to some one person, you know, please, sir, may I have some porridge. We're supposed to have a set of rules and laws that we've all agreed on, at least had an opportunity to have our say through our elected representatives. And if someone tries to deviate from those things and deviate from the Constitution, at some point they're not allowed to do that. And I think that point runs a lot faster than probably some others might argue. But just this concept of having to go and grovel to a particular person is something that I think that is sort of disheartening, and I don't think any person is benevolent enough to exercise that level of power for any length of time in a way that is beneficial to everyone in all circumstances and honoring of liberty. I don't think I could be that type of benevolent dictator, and I don't mean to use that word in a derogatory way, but it's when one person's making the decisions. I mean, it's a form of government that we've all studied, and there's a label for that, and that's the only label I know to use. So I just think that we have to be very, very careful before we hand one person lots of power that they exercise for a very long period of time, because I am untrustworthy to exercise that power, as I believe everyone else is.
And I think we've covered the questions, but I do want to give the last word to our statewide elected official, Treasurer Ball.
You're on mute.
Thank you very much. The only thing I would add is that first principles matter. You know, we think about these things in times when there's not a crisis, because when a crisis occurs, then we're guarded by them. And I think it's important for us to remember those things we thought about before this crisis happened, those things we came to believe in, and stick to those things.
Okay, with that, thank you all for a very informative discussion. And we certainly have much to think about in these extraordinary times. This has been some of the hardest legal work of my life the last 7 months. And quite frankly, I would prefer not to do it again. But thanks to everyone. A reminder that we do have an additional panel tomorrow. So if you're able to make that, please do so. And with that, thank you to all of us, all of our panelists, and to everyone who attended.